Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Yes, it is very conservative, no doubt, no doubt. But in some cases, depending on what the issues are, that really can make for very interesting bedfellows when it comes to the ruling. But on just the general idea, we can talk about this all day. We're both nerds, like we can get into this. But
yes, we are.
We have time for one more question for me to pose to you. Yeah. And that was, what advice would you give to people who want to understand the courts better? I'm Kimberly Atkinstor, and this is Justice by Design. So the form of justice in the title that we're going to be talking about today is a little different from what we usually do, but maybe not so much. I want to spend this episode talking about justices, specifically the justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. I've heard from a lot of listeners and viewers questions about how to understand the court better, what they should be looking out for, just asking a lot of general questions that I may not always have the answer to. And yes, I have spent a lot of time studying the law, practicing law, covering the Supreme Court for, by and large, for going on 20 years now. And there are a lot of things that I do know, but there are a lot of things that I turn to others, the experts, to help me understand more about the courts. And one of those is my guest today, Adam Feldman, who is the creator and author of the Empirical SCOTUS blog and also the Legalytics Substack newsletter. And he is the former digital editor for SCOTUS blog, where he used to produce these stat packs that, as a journalist, like, it was like fresh meat. Like, I just love those and diving into them and learning more about the court that you might miss, even if you're watching every argument and keeping up to date on every case. To step back for the big picture, using data is so important. And I think it's really crucially important right now as more people are looking, trying to understand the courts and the judiciary as part of our government and our functioning democracy. So, Adam, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So I gave you a little bit of a bio, but I always start by asking my guests to introduce themselves a little bit, sort of tell us how you got to this place of looking at the SCOTUS through data.
Absolutely. So I'm trained as an attorney, and after law school, I practiced in trial litigation for about 4 years. During that time, I'm also a pretty avid reader, and I've been into statistics and analytics, especially at that time, really related to sports. I read about how data applies to law, and I started seeing some parallels about how probability is used in thinking about both sports and the law, and that there was this kind of this industry beginning around using data and law, and something that I thought, you know, my skill set spoke to well and that I could get ahead of, but I also needed to train myself a little bit more in using these methodologies. And look, I'm a glutton for academia, so I took a step back from my my practice and went into a PhD program in political science, where I was really focused on quantitative study of law. And I completed that around 2017 and have been teaching and consulting with attorneys doing legal strategy and doing a lot of writing since then.
That's great. That's great. So I want to sort of start off this discussion. One reason why I invited you on was from reading your Substack newsletter, which really does a great job in making me think about even cases that I've been discussing or writing about in a different new way, or even areas of law that are making me think about or giving me new information or new data to give me a different vantage point or some enlightenment in that area. And one recent one I thought was really good that I'd love to talk to you about is about the court's religion docket right now. You sort of opened it with a discussion of a case that is on the docket right now, which could lead to the first religious charter school in the country. And it really gets to one of the ways the religion docket has played out. It's playing out in a lot of different ways, but one is this tension between the establishment clause, which prevents governments from imposing religion or favoring one religion over another, and the free exercise clause, which is the individual right we all have to practice whatever religion or no religion as we see fit and be able to make those choices in doing so. So just tell us a little bit about that conflict and why you are focusing on that among the issues that you're looking at the court this term.
Well, you're speaking right to my heart because I teach this also, and I teach First Amendment, so I think about these issues quite a bit, and I've been teaching this over about 10 years now, just under 10 years, and there's so many fresh cases coming up right now that I've had to revamp the curriculum, and I'm probably going to have to do it again after this term.
Yes, you will. Yes, yeah. You will.
it is a tension, but it's something that's been resolved over the last few years when they've had similar cases in a pretty conservative direction. And you know what I mean by that is allowing more of the establishment of religion to kind of seep into to daily life, and so there is a constant tension between allowing people to practice religion the way they feel like they should practice and having religion come into the public sector, which when it does so, it usually favors one brand of religion, one sect of religion over another. And that's where these things balance out. And so, you know, with the religious charter school case in Oklahoma, one of the facets of it is that obviously it would be focused on specific types of religion, and so that would be something that implicates the Establishment Clause. But it's being argued as a free exercise case where you have these groups that want to be able to bring religion into publicly funded education and to be able to exercise it through their daily lives. And so that's kind of what's being balanced out and weighed by the justices in a case like this.
So tell us how we got to this point, because when I was in law school, I'm reminded now it's been 30 years since I began my legal studies, which, you know, is really tough to admit to myself.
You're putting it out there.
But you know, I thought it was pretty clear. There's always tension between these two aspects of the same amendment, but that there were pretty clear lines when it came to government money going to religious teaching. And I'm somebody who went to a religious high school. I understand the difference. I understand the value of that education. But the Constitution said something different. But it seems, as you pointed out, in recent years, we have seen a shift. There were cases that were the case that was based in Boston, for example, where when they opened up the ability for people to suggest flags to fly on City Hall Plaza and rejected one that was religious because, you know, it's City Hall Plaza, the court ruled in favor of the person who wanted to raise the religious flag. You see the court allowing coaches who are religious to pray on the field before games, and in a way that seemed to encourage students to do the same. How do you quantify the court's jurisprudence on that tension between not establishing any religion, but allowing people their free exercise to participate over time? What does the data show?
Well, I mean, first, kind of anecdotally, I think the floodgates kind of opened a little bit earlier on. So you had cases like the Ten Commandments case in Van Orden, which was in the early 2000s, where the Ten Commandments were allowed on public ground in Texas. And you had the case where there was the creche and menorah allowed on public ground. And, you know, that didn't violate free exercise, at least according to the court, because you had multiple types of religion that were that were shown there. But now we have a conservative majority on the court, and I don't think that there's much argument in the opposite direction, especially since Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed in 2020. You have what looks like a 6-3 majority that's conservative, although I and others have parsed it in different ways. So you can look at it, whether it's 6-3, it's clearly a majority conservative court, and for all intents and purposes, more conservative than it has been, in recent memory. And this court has, through this 6-3 majority, has made several rulings that have opened the doors to more religion in public life. And you'd mentioned the Kennedy versus Bremerton, the case with the coach praying on the field. There's Carson versus Macon, another one that opened up money going into religion. And so we've seen through this majority, I mean, if we're talking about quantifying, we've seen this justice dynamic where you have the conservative justice and the majority in these First Amendment religion cases. And the argument in this case also seemed to go into the direction of doing kind of a similar thing. Now, one of the differences that Justice Barrett was recused from this case. So because she recused herself, it's not going to be a 9-justice vote. It's going to be an 8-justice vote. And, you know, because of that, there might be some kind of nuance that goes on. I mean, the last time we had a regular 8-justice court, was after Scalia passed away and, before Justice Gorsuch was confirmed. And we saw the justices meet in the middle probably more often, than they had in the past because you didn't have an odd number of justices. And so we might get something where, you have like a Roberts who tries to bring the two sides together. And I'm not quite sure how that would play out, but because he could be the deciding vote on, you know, if it does go away where you have the more conservative justices on the right, the more progressive justices on the left, and Roberts having to be the justice that, you know, can kind of swing it one way or the other, he's shown a propensity to try to kind of moderate these rulings and not make them go overly one way or the other. That said, he's been in the conservative majority in the other recent religion cases. And so if he was going to go one way or the other and I had to make a call on that, I would say he's more likely to go with the with putting money into these charter schools than not.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Yeah, that seemed to be the case coming out. Although I always say it's a fool's errand to predict a case just by oral argument. I think if tea leaves were to be read, that is exactly right. Now, we can't just talk about the religion docket by just talking about the justices. And it's another reason I like empirical SCOTUS so much is that you look at other factors like who is bringing these cases, who is writing amicus briefs, so-called friend of the court briefs from people who are not parties to litigation, but who have some sort of interest and cachet that can add some, you know, at least they think they can add some light to the legal analysis. And what I have definitely noticed in the last 20 years covering the court is an increase in advocacy religious groups that bring some of these cases, organizations like the Beckett Fund or Alliance Defending Freedom. And I think that gets to a little bit what the point that you made about, yes, when we're talking about freedom of religion, it's supposed to be free exercise, even though that part of the First Amendment seems to be winning at the court. It's supposed to be free exercise of any religion or the ability not to have any religion. But what you're seeing is a lot of the litigants, both the litigants themselves and the legal groups bringing these challenges are, or trying to impact these policies in the case of charter schools being Christian organizations themselves. How does that impact where the Constitution has gone in terms of how the Supreme Court sees it?
It's a great question. And, you know, obviously, I think things have changed over the last 20 years and even more over the last 5 years in terms of the perspective of the justices' perspective on this issue. And, you know, part of what I look at and what's tricky as a social scientist as well is trying to figure out the kind of what we'd call in social science the causal mechanism. What you know I mean by that is, are the justices looking to these groups to support positions that they already have, or are they being convinced by these groups to move in a certain way? But what we see is that certain justices on the right are more likely to cite these briefs and their opinions, these amici briefs from these religious groups. And if they cite them and it makes its way into a majority opinion, then you might see some kind of response to this by who, you know, what has been more the progressive side of the court in dissent. And you know, they might look to the briefs that are cited in the majority to try to rebut those positions, or they might look to their own set of briefs that are speaking more to the free exercise point of view and cite those. But the use of amici briefs has gone up. The number of filings in these briefs has gone up exponentially, where you know we have some cases now with 100 or more amici briefs filed, and that you know ups the load, the workload of the justices, which is its own kind of bag of worms to talk about as well. But to stay on the religion topic, you know, look, the country historically has been, you know, majority Christian. And when we look at the founders, you know, they were, you know, mainly religious white men. And so there are these roots that I think, you know, were kind of planted that when you have more originalist justices who are looking at the past and how the Constitution was framed and who the framers were, they look back to these principles, which, you know, are kind of, there's this tension between some of the wording in the Constitution and then who these people were at that point in time. And I think we see that tension playing out now. And, you know, there's this misconception, I think, that some people have, that there is a separation of church and state, at least in actual wording in the Constitution, which doesn't exist. You know, we have the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause in the First Amendment, and that speaks to the separation of church and state. But ultimately, we have a lot of this tension. We have these justices who on the right are really originalist justices who are looking at that history. And then we have these groups who are playing into this discussion, and so we have the justices looking to these groups to either support the positions they're making or to give them advice on policy, all of these different positions from the amici briefs.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about another area that you look into in your work, and that is what's happening at the state court level, which is crucially, crucially important to Americans' everyday lives in a way that I think probably much more so than what the Supreme Court does. Yes, the Supreme Court is taking up more big, high impact cases that affect all of Americans, to be sure. But what's going on locally is also important. And I just, because there aren't enough hours in the day, can't always keep up with what's going on there. But what has been some of the trends you have seen about the state courts, either how they, what kinds of cases they're taking up more? I know there is there's been a lot of movement in that area after Dobbs on reproductive rights, for example. Mm-hmm. But what are things that, what as you see, are things that Americans may be missing, but that's important, that's taking place right at the highest court of their individual states?
Well, what's interesting is that I think you point this out, you know, rightly, that you know, vast majority of litigation that's going on in the United States is through state courts, and you know, I think there probably is this misconception because federal courts get publicized so much more, and sometimes they have these, you know, sexier cases that are more political and that people, you know, are following around the country, where, you know, as you mentioned, state court decisions are more localized, although their impact can be felt nationally sometimes, especially when they're through big states' courts that other states kind of look to see how doctrine is evolving. And these types of cases, kind of interestingly, sometimes have these constitutional parallels, or they're looking at the Constitution even though they're state courts, and there's this whole jurisdictional issue as to what state courts should be looking at versus federal courts. But the bottom line is you have these big issues that are implicated at the state level. And, a lot of the disputes are business oriented. That's, where I see a lot of the energy focused. But when we look into these more kind of personal civil rights and civil liberties issues, we do see things like speech, like equal protection coming up and kind of focused at these issues that deal with state actors. So, I think jurisdictionally, like which courts should be handling these cases, sometimes is an issue that the courts themselves are looking at and trying to figure out and adapt. And some of that comes down to specific judges and how they think these processes should be read. But ultimately, when we look at some of these big state courts and the decisions they're making, they implicate the Constitution and the way that people are impacted, especially in these states like California and Texas and New York, where you have these major population centers. And then you get the precedent that's set down. You have a lot of employment discrimination cases. That's a big issue at the state level. So workers' rights and things of that nature oftentimes come up through the state's courts. If you have a big decision on that, whether it's union based or whether it's something that can set precedent across a big state, then what ends up happening is you have this kind of flourishing of litigation that comes up from those cases. And because the number of the cases are so much greater at the state level, the number of cases that impacts is generally greater too. In terms of overall kind of optics, I think there's this disconnect between what people see at the public level and what actually goes on at the state level.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
I'm so glad you said that because, when I practiced law, I didn't practice for very long, but when I did, I was a litigator with a pretty busy caseload. And I spent a lot of time doing both employment discrimination cases, as you said, which is under state law, as well as a lot of consumer protection litigation, which is under the purview of state law. And I think people don't realize that even as cases make their way up and go to the highest state court, it's not like the Supreme Court can just swoop in and say, oh, we like this or we don't like this, and take up a case. Even if somebody tries to appeal to the Supreme Court, if the state court made a decision based on state law, by and large, the rule by the Supreme Court is hands off.
Yeah.
They won't come in and say that. So what the state courts say is really the rule of that's the rule. That's the rule. And that's the law. And I don't think that people really have that understanding. And on that vein, Adam, what are other things that just in your work, understanding the law as you do by the numbers, by the empirical data, what are other misconceptions that you think people have about the judiciary and how it works that you can see very clearly, but you understand how people don't get it?
Yeah, I want to piggyback first off of one of the points you made about the state Supreme Courts being courts of last resort on most of these cases. And, when we look at the Supreme Court's docket over time, it's, over the last century, it's gone from 200 cases or so orally argued to 60 to 70 now. So we're cutting it down below, one third of what it used to be. And so, not only does the Supreme Court not hear a majority of state court decisions, but it's only hearing a small number of decisions in total each year. So that really means that the likelihood that a state Supreme Court decision gets revisited by the U.S. Supreme Court is minimal, you know, notwithstanding the state law aspect of the doctrine, where the Supreme Court won't or shouldn't pick up something that is a purely state law issue. So I think they're, you know, that people might not be tuned into just how few cases the Supreme Court's hearing. And that, you know, when you have these big ticket cases, some of which that, you know, we've seen argued this year, including the Oklahoma charter school case, you know, they get backloaded to the end of the term. So,
right.
You know, we end up seeing, you know, of those 60 cases, the majority of them come in June before the end of the term, which generally is, you know, one of the last few days in June, if the justices get to everything by then. And so, you know, it's generally a slow process from when arguments start in October and until May, and then it really picks up speed. So for, you know, those of us who are doing statistical work, that, you know, means that we're doing a lot of crunching in number crunching in June, especially if, you know, we want to get out things like the stat pack as soon as the term ends. So, you know, in terms of the timeline, I think that's important. In terms of the caseload, that's important. You know, we talked about amici and how they're having a more prominent role now. And you know, some of the other things we're seeing are focal points changing. So for instance, the Fifth Circuit, which is one of the southern circuits, you have a lot of judges on the Fifth in Texas, and the Supreme Court's hearing more of their cases. And, you know, there's a variety of issues for reasons why. At least, you know, we can, you know, speculate as to why the justices don't actually give these reasons, but because we've seen these clusters of cases, you know, the Fifth Circuit does seem to be taking these salient issues that interest the Supreme Court. And now, you know, one of the surprises has been that, you know, especially in the last few years, that the Supreme Court, which is majority conservative, has not always sided with the Fifth Circuit decisions, which are primarily conservative, but, you know, it's, some, including myself, have seen that in some instances, the Fifth Circuit has actually pushed farther in the conservative direction, at least in the kind of immediate time, than the Supreme Court has been willing to go. So, you know, as much as we call the Supreme Court a conservative court, and I think in, you know, the majority of cases it hears, it does move in a conservative direction, it doesn't always work in that way. And yeah. And so there are nuances of what goes on. And you have these different kind of brands of what it means to be conservative on the Supreme Court. So sometimes you'll have somebody like Justice Thomas, who tends to be on the right of the court, along with Justice Alito, who will dissent by himself. And, you know, Thomas is actually, and this is an interesting statistic, but he's dissented alone more than any other justice since Justice Douglas, who did this quite a bit in the, you know, around the Warren Court time and thereafter. But, you know, Justice Douglas was a bit of an anomaly on the court. And otherwise, you know, Justice Thomas, even though he's been on a court which has been primarily conservative since he joined in 91, he still dissents more than any justice by a good deal. Justice Sotomayor has caught up a little bit in recent years, but if you look at the historic arc, Justice Thomas dissents more than anybody, which is, you know, might be surprising when we think about the tenor of the court, that we have justices who are clearly farther to the right than others, and some that are more in the middle. And although that middle is to the right, which, you know, is an interesting complexity. So if we look at the court as a whole, it's to the right of where it has been. But you still have justices farther on the end, more in the middle. And then you have your progressive justices who haven't really changed around a lot in their positions for, you know, many years, you know, including Justice Ginsburg and Breyer and the kind of previous liberal wing on the court. So, you know, we see these changes, and we see changes in the cases that the Supreme Court's taking up. But, you know, I think you also noted importantly that there's a lot of work being done in law that doesn't make the major headlines of the national news, and that have huge impacts, because the Supreme Court only hears a you know, kind of a small number of cases each term. So you have these courts of appeals and the federal courts and state Supreme Courts and even state appeals courts at the state level who are really making these decisions and setting precedent for their jurisdictions that, you know, the Supreme Court isn't ruling on. One other thing I'll throw in there, just an interesting stat point that maybe not everybody's tuned in on, but the Supreme Court, in the cases they take, they reverse more often, much more frequently than they affirm. And the theory behind that is that if they affirm, what they're doing is they're just keeping precedent as it is, which might create, national precedent, which does have an impact. But, if the Supreme Court wants to have an even greater impact, it's by overturning a lower court decision. So the theory is they're going to take more cases that they want to overturn than they do that they want to affirm. And statistically, we've seen that play out as, where they're overturning about 2/3 of the cases that they take.
Which is probably also because in part due to the fact that they're taking fewer cases. I mean, they are more willing to, speak by not taking up a case at all in cases that they would have affirmed, and focus on the ones that they are more likely to overturn. So that's a good point. That makes a lot of sense. And also, I want to go back to the point about the conservatives versus the liberals on the court, and that most people really think about the court as a 6-3. And I do use that shorthand a lot myself, but I think a lot of times, depending on the issue, it is much more likely that the court tends to break 3-something-something. So the 3 Democratic appointed justices were very, very likely to be together.
Yeah.
And then among the others, it might be 3-2-4. It might be 3-3-3. Mm-hmm. And you don't really know how, but you have those who are more toward the center. You may get Kavanaugh and Barrett, mm-hmm, in a 2 and the other 4. So it creates a lot of interesting dynamics that make the makeup of this court a lot closer than I think people realize. Yes, it is very conservative, no doubt. No doubt. But in some cases, depending on what the issues are, that really can make for very interesting bedfellows when it comes to the ruling. But on just the general idea, we can talk about this all day. We're both nerds. Like, we can get into this. But
yes, we are.
We have time for one more question for me to pose to you. Yeah. And that was what advice would you give to people who want to understand the courts better, but who don't necessarily know where to look? And sometimes it's a lot of information that's confusing. Sometimes, as we pointed out, it's not enough because important cases don't rise to the top of headlines and news publications. For people who really just want to understand it better, where should they go besides empirical SCOTUS?
Right. So, and Legalytics, we're going to we'll throw those both in there. There's some great commentary that comes out about the court from some of the websites that I've worked with. SCOTUS blog does a good job usually of having somebody write about the cases in more of a plain English form. There's another website called Oye, and oye.org. They'll give a kind of plain English summary of cases. Looking for these kind of secondary sources, one of the problems I think that people face is trying to find a neutral source because, like most media, it tends to be skewed one way or the other. And so that might mean reading sources from the left and the right, if you really wanted to have a kind of perspective on what's actually going on and, kind of get away from the positioning on the issues. But finding those sources and trying to triangulate where the honest middle actually is, but also finding in language that you can understand. And that's why some of these websites that, like SCOTUS blog, that speak in a way, or when you read at least the commentary on the cases, speak in a way that people can understand without a legal background. Those are, I think, helpful resources. And that's something that I've been trying to adapt to and adopt as I've evolved as a writer, talking to people in a way that, even if you're not a lawyer, you can understand and at least understand the ramifications of the cases. And the fact that, you have these complex cases that affect people that have really no knowledge of the law, I think, it implicates the importance of having some source that describes these things in words that people can understand.
All right. Well, thank you for doing that work. I, as I said, I find your work immensely useful, both as a journalist and as a citizen. I will put links in the show notes to Empirical SCOTUS and Legalytics. And Adam Feldman, thank you so much for joining me on Justice by Design.
That's great. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you, our listeners and viewers, for joining as well. Don't forget to follow and subscribe where you get this podcast. It's absolutely free, but it ensures that you won't miss a single episode of these important discussions. Also, give a good rating to the podcast because that helps other people find it and spread the word about all the ways people are working to find solutions to things, including trying to explain SCOTUS and other courts in a way that Americans can understand, whether you went to law school, but especially if you didn't. And don't forget to join me again next week for another episode of Justice by Design. I'm Kimberly Atkinstor.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.